to your parents, walidain to the mother and father. And then it says that imma yablughanna indaka al-kibar ahaduhuma aw kilahuma, and when one of them or maybe both of them have become an old, now they are in the age where they need you, they have become old, fala taqul lahuma uffin, and do not say even a word in to them that will hurt them. So have a good speech with them. And this is what Quran is talking about, and this is what Quran emphasizes. Therefore, we need to obey the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in regards to our parents. And Allah says about the rahmah, about the mercy, having a mercy upon them, talking to them in a good manner, and taking care of them. And this taking care of them means that we take care of them by ourselves, not others. And obviously, and then it says that you must pray for your parents. وَقُلْ رَبِّ رَحَمْهُمَا كَمَا رَبَّيَانِ صَغِيرًا, and say, oh Lord, have mercy upon them the way they had mercy upon me. When I was a child, they were taking care of me. They were very much caring about me. They had mercy upon me. So, oh Allah, you also have mercy upon them, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
American hypocrisy knows no limits. It not only acts as the policeman of the world, but has also appointed itself the judge of human rights. What you heard was part of an article authored by Khadija Ali, a political analyst. The article is titled, America Tortures Gitmo Inmates While Shamelessly Lectures Others About Human Rights. Stay tuned for more. American hypocrisy knows no limits. It not only acts as the policeman of the world, but has also appointed itself the judge of human rights. Its own despicable conduct at home and abroad cannot be discussed, nor that of its friends and allies, such as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. The U.S. has even coined fancy terms to camouflage its horrific conduct. Torture is euphemistically called enhanced interrogation technique, while kidnapping is referred to as extraordinary rendition. One would love to subject some U.S. officials to enhanced interrogation techniques and ask how they feel. These hypocritical expressions are coined in the aftermath of 9/11 and the people that were arrested accusing them of involvement in the attacks. The torture chamber at the illegally occupied Cuban island of Guantanamo Bay was opened in February 2002, where, according to Donald Rumsfeld, the people shipped there were the worst of the worst. These included boys as young as 12 and men as old as 70. Afghanistan's ambassador to Pakistan, Abdusalam Zaif, was among them. He was arrested in Islamabad and General Musharraf's regime in violation of all diplomatic norms handed him to the Americans. Saif was released from Guantanamo Bay in 2005 and went on to write a book about his experiences. At its height, there were 700 prisoners held at Gitmo. Today, there are less than 40, but lest we forget them. It is important to highlight their plight. The rest have since been released because there was absolutely no evidence of their involvement in any of the crimes of the Americans accused them of committing. Let us recall that among those incarcerated like animals in cages was Omar Khadr, barely 15, when he was brought to Gitmo in October 2002. He had multiple bullet wounds in his body after a firefight between American troops and some Taliban fighters in the village of Ayokel. He was accused of killing an American soldier even though forensic analysis showed he had American grenade shrapnel in his body. Omar Khadr was subjected to extreme torture, prolonged sleep deprivation, held in extremely stressful positions as well as dogs set upon him, scratching into his still fresh wounds. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda family member since his father, Ahmad Saeed Khadr, lived in the same compound in Jalalabad where Osama bin Laden had lived. It was through the efforts of his lawyers, Dennis Edney, that he was rescued from the torture chamber in 2012. The Stephen Harper regime in Canada did everything in its power to keep him there. Khadr was forced to enter into a plea bargain to secure his release from Gitmo, even though he initially refused to do so. In return for accepting his guilt in throwing the grenade that killed Sergeant Spears, he was given a reduced sentence, of which he served 1 year in Gitmo and the rest to be served in Canada. Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, was accused of being an Al-Qaeda leader. The extreme torture he was subjected to is illustrative of U.S. criminal conduct. He was captured, along with about 50 other men, in a joint operation in August 2002 by a group of FBI and CIA agents aided by Pakistani forces in Faisalabad, Pakistan. Abu Zubaydah was severely injured, shot in the thigh and stomach, and might have died, but the CIA flew in an American surgeon to patch him up. It was not a humanitarian gesture. CIA officials wanted to keep him alive to interrogate him. Even so, his captors continued to torture him by withholding pain medication. Abu Zubaydah is a Saudi citizen who in 1980s helped run the Khaldan camp, a Mujahideen training facility set up in Afghanistan with CIA help during the Soviet occupation. So the CIA knew precisely who he was, an American ally in the fight against the Soviets. Yet Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The CIA informed Assistant Attorney General J. Bybee that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as an Al-Qaeda coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications, the agency alleged. George W. Bush, a complete dunce, used his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so that they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. But as Rebecca Gordon reveals in her brilliant piece in Counterpunch, none of it was true. American officials lied through their teeth to justify their crimes against Abu Zubaydah and many other innocent people. The CIA hired two contractors, the psychologists Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, to work on Abu Zubaydah. Their mission was to induce what they called learned helplessness, meant to reduce a suspect's resistance to interrogation. They charged $81 million for their services to test their theories about using torture to extract information. Using a plan drawn up by Jessen and Mitchell, Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times in the course of a single month. What is waterboarding? It included strapping a victim to a wooden board, placing cloth over his entire face, and gradually pouring water through the cloth until he began to choke. At one point during this endless cycle of torture, the Senate committee reported that Abu Zubaydah became completely unresponsive, with bubbles rising through his open, full mouth. Each of those 83 uses of what was called the watering cycle consisted of four steps. Number one, demands for information interspersed with the application of the water just short of blocking his airway. Number two, escalation of the amount of water applied until it blocked his airway and he started to have involuntary spasms. Number three, raising the waterboard to clear subject's airway. And number four, lowering of the waterboard and return to demands for information. Throughout the CIA videotaped Abu Zubaydah's torture, but destroyed the tapes in 2005 when the news of their existence leaked and the embarrassment and possible future culpability of the agency seemed increasingly to be at stake. CIA Director Michael Hayden would later assure CNN that the tapes had been destroyed only because they no longer had intelligence value and they posed a security risk, whose security one wonders. In addition to waterboarding, the Senate torture report indicates that Abu Zubaydah endured excruciating stress positions which caused terrible pain without leaving a mark, sleep deprivation for up to 180 hours, which generally induces hallucinations or psychosis, unrelenting exposure to loud noises, another psychosis inducer, walling, the agency's term for repeatedly slamming the shoulder blades into a flexible false wall. Though Abu Zubaydah told the International Committee of the Red Cross that when this was first done to him, he was slammed directly against a hard concrete wall, and confinement for hours in a box so cramped that he could not stand up inside it. All of these methods of torture had been given explicit approval in a memo written to the CIA's head lawyer, John Rizzo, by Jay Bybee, who was then serving in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. In that memo, Bybee approved the use of 10 different techniques on Abu Zubaydah. Make no mistake, American officials are war criminals and torturers. The U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Torture report on December 2014 confirmed this in writing.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Once every 100,000 years, gold is created from the collision of neutron stars. Mysterious gold instantly melted into humanity's desire, contained the magic which enabled civilizations to flourish and fueled the desire that made people venture across oceans. But why do we lust after gold? And does humanity own gold, or does gold own humanity? I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For centuries, gold was the economic index which dominated the world before it lost to the dollar. But the 2008 financial meltdown has brought gold back from oblivion. Gold is now dominating the world once again, but why is it gold again? In 2008, gold woke up from its deep, dark sleep. As the dollar became unstable during the U.S. financial crisis, people rushed to gold. And in August of 2011, the twisted destiny recurred. The new gold rush started again. Pursuit has begun once again, and stay with us as we take a look into the history of gold from its glittering past to its sudden return.
Gold.
That is gold.
Kingai.
King or gold.
Gold.
With gold.
Gold.
Il oro.
The oro.
Oro.
Into gold.
Sold gold.
Gold.
Gold price.
Gold mines.
Gold is undervalued.
Currency, which reflects human instincts, is very much alive. Money gained humanity's passionate desire since its creation. Money was at the center of wars and economies. Its origin can be traced back to Mesopotamia. Thousands of years ago, Sumerians were the first ever to develop trade. Since then, many types of currency have appeared in history. Trading goods for goods appeared first. Grains, essential for everyone, were used as currency in many areas. As time passed, smaller objects were used for trading to facilitate easier transportation and exchange. Various metals became the new currency, as they were easily transportable and did not rot. But not all metals were permanently stable. In the end, gold, whose value was accepted consistently as a stable metal, became the best currency. Gold, which is evaluated by its weight and purity, has no exchange rate or nationality. Due to its high value, large trades were made possible with just small amounts of gold. It was the best currency that was accepted everywhere. In 700 BC, the kingdom of Lydia, which ruled Turkey, became the birthplace of the best invention in the history of currency. The capital of the kingdom was Sardis. It was the hub of the East and West, and as trading became important, the need for currency grew. Lydia dominated Asia Minor. It expanded its boundaries as the ancient empire, securing the trade route linking an area of over 2,700 kilometers. Lydia invented the world's first gold coins, using their abundant resources of gold, and built an affluent kingdom.
And this started with King Croesus of Lydia, which is a very famous name. And he really produced the first gold coins and used it particularly to pay soldiers and military people.
In the early 7th century BC, Lydians minted the world's first coins. Gold coins, which feature a lion's head, the symbol of Lydia, became the kingdom's representative export goods. As the world's first gold coins and the world's first empire currency, Lydia's coins spread through Asia Minor and Greece. They became a necessity for trade in the Mediterranean. Goods, art, people, and knowledge gathered in Lydia, and humanity's first retail businesses began. With a single shiny gold coin, people were able to buy horses or delicious food. It also reduced shopping time. A new world had opened up for humanity. But if the Lydians were the first to invent coins, the Greeks were the first to turn coin making into an art form. Each city imprinted its own unique symbols. They were the symbols of national strength. Greek coins circulated the Mediterranean through marine commerce. Gold coins brought revolutionary developments in commerce and became the foundation of civilizations. Education also developed quickly along with the coins. A hundred years after the birth of gold coins, the currency revolution moved to Rome. Coins featuring the emperor's face, as well as other royalty, were widely used among laymen. As the territory of the Roman Empire expanded, the amount of gold attained through looting and mining grew exponentially. Consequently, the Romans issued more gold coins, and these coins strengthened the empire. Gold coins were what built the Roman Empire. In 395 AD, after the Roman Empire divided into two, Western Rome collapsed within the next 100 years. However, the surviving Eastern Rome continued to write history for another 1,000 years. Constantine the Great moved Rome's capital to Byzantium and founded the Byzantine Empire. Constantine the Great, who reunited Rome, declared freedom from religion and chose Sunday as a day of rest. He also issued a new gold coin called solidus. This is Byzant, the best currency. The Byzant, with a 98% purity, weighed 4.5 grams. The Byzant was the basic currency of the Middle Ages that everyone could trust and use. It was the longest surviving currency in history.
Really ran from about 500. Well, really 300 AD, but 500 AD in Istanbul itself, and lasted for almost 1,000 years, really with the weight and the purity of it unchanged. There were some years when it was a problem, but it did last almost for 1,000 years, the Byzantine solidus. It was a 1,000-year coin, if you like.
The Byzant was the revenue source to maintain a large army and the means of controlling the empire. That is why the Byzant is called the dollar of the Middle Ages. The dollar of the Middle Ages surpasses today's dollar in terms of stability and value. While today's dollar faced a crisis within 100 years, the Byzant survived for 1,000 years. The Byzant was the partner that supported the kingdom for 1,000 years. The value of gold transcends time and space and gives faith to people. But there was a critical weakness even to gold, the best currency. There is a limit to the production of gold, and there are three ways to overcome the limit. One was to endure the lack of currency, and the other was to bring in gold from other regions through trade and loot. The last method was currency degradation, by making more coins with the same amount of gold. People began to deceive others by making new coins using clipped edges of existing coins.
And up until 1696, coins were struck onto a rough blank. So you used to be able to, if you're a very unscrupulous silversmith, you could clip the edges and get free silver. And so there were many laws that were passed to try and stop this. And in 1696, what they did was that they made sure that all the coins were circular with a milled edge. So that stopped the practice of coin clipping.
This is the origin of how the coin edges look today. Clipping of coin edges brought many problems. The value of currency fell, and prices began to inflate. New coins had to be issued to win people's trust. Sir Isaac Newton stepped up to solve all these problems.
And one of his big responsibilities was to prevent forgery. So one of the ways he did that was by making sure that all the coins had a milled edge around them, because if the edge is milled with little grooves, it's impossible to clip off a little bit of the coin.
The grooves on the coins that Newton made are used on today's coins as well. The grooves mark the human greed for gold. Gold, however, was never used as the main currency in the East. As the value of gold developed the currency system in the West, brass coins backed by the government played a similar role in the East. Whether it be gold or a brass coin, if the receiver had trust in it, that was enough. People had faith in the government. The first coins in the East were made during the Jin Dynasty. They believed the sky was round and the land was square. So they made a round coin with a square hole in the middle. This shape became the basic shape of Eastern coins for 2,000 years. The trust of currency gave birth to the world's first paper money in China. Gyoza, issued in Buxong in 1023, was the first paper money. When Emperor Kublai Khan of the Yuan Dynasty mass-produced bozhou and circulated them through Eurasia, the era of paper currency began. Paper money was made of paper, but it ceased to be just ordinary paper. Kublai Khan is described as an alchemist in the travels of Marco Polo. Paper currency was like magic to the Westerners who were using gold coins. During the Yuan Dynasty, the government forcefully retained gold, silver, and copper, and with its guarantee, paper money was issued. With the circulation of paper money, less money was spent on producing coins, which led to a better financial status of the government, and thus led to a more active commerce. Replacing the gold with paper money opened up a new golden era in the East. At the end of the 15th century, gold had cast a spell on people and made them cross the oceans, risking their lives. But the lives of Europeans were also shaken up by gold. At the time, the population, which had been devastated by the plague, was bouncing back. Price of commodities was also increasing. Moreover, as gold and silver from the New World poured into Europe, prices soared uncontrollably. The price revolution of the 16th century began. treasure from the New World created a large gap between the rich and the poor.
And this is at a time when that is much more than a week's earnings in the late. It's more like 2 weeks' earnings. So it is a lot of time to earn the smallest coin. And therefore, ordinary people do not have gold coins. It is something for the rich to have.
Prices quadrupled and sextupled. First, landowners who received a consistent amount of rent went bankrupt. Farmers who didn't have money to rent land became wage laborers. On the other hand, the royal families and noblemen enjoyed an unprecedented extravagance. Gold instantly spread throughout European countries, and in its wake, only collapsed industries and financial crisis remained. Such was the curse of gold. The price revolution continued on for over 100 years without any resolution. It was the longest inflation in history. When commerce expanded and capitalism developed, a barter economy emerged. A system of an exchange of promissory notes for foreign currency began. 48 types of gold coins used in Europe in the 16th century were all exchangeable. Thus, financial innovation was propelled by the power of gold. In the early 19th century, gold faced a new era. Money was dependent upon the value of gold. A system of gold and money exchange emerged. Since then, history repeatedly introduced and discarded the gold standard. In 1819, England pegged the value of pounds to gold and circulated paper money that could be exchanged for gold at any time. By 1870, most countries had adopted the gold standard, and the pound, which could be exchanged for gold, became the key currency around the world.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah.
It appeared that natural, animalistic, and satanic aspirations had closed their eyes and ears and blinded and defended them from spirituality. Nevertheless, what made you triumph is the faith and sincerity within you which is absent in your enemies. You enter the battlefield for Allah and they for Satan. They are the enemy of the Satan's party and you of Allah's party. What made you victorious is the battle against the Satan of the internal battlefield.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regard to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, he says that we must all get under the standard and banner of Islam, but not in terms of slogan. It must be in truth and in fact. Now, this is very clear that what Imam Khomeini is trying to say. He says that if we want to come under the slogan, if we want to come under the banner of Islam, and we want the Islamic standards in the society, then it should not be in terms of slogan. Generally, we see that people start performing something or they wish to have something, but later that thing becomes slogan. For example, we have seen in the history that the feminism, it started with an ideology that the women who are not getting their right should have their right. And later, with the passage of time, the main theme has become a slogan and it has been changed to something else. They have gone to another way, which is the wrong way. On the other hand, we can see like other revolutions that we have in the world that it was started with an ideology, but later they forgot the ideology and it is changed to something else. Why? Because people have changed it into the terms of slogan. In Islam, when we talk about Islam, it is important to practically practice Islam, to have Islam in our faith, and to have the knowledge of Islam. If we do not convey the knowledge to our generations, if we are not educating our children about the real Islam, then obviously it will become a slogan for us as well, as we have now. You know, in the Western world, we can see that they know Muslims as in two groups, the practicing Muslim and non-practicing Muslim. So what's the difference? The difference is that the non-practicing Muslim are known as Muslim, but they follow the slogan of Islam. They are not practicing Muslim. They do not have applied the Islam into their life. And therefore, that is what Imam Khomeini is saying, that this revolution that they had, the Islamic country that they have, if we want to come under the standards and the banner of Islam, it should be with practice. It should be with the truth. And in fact, it should be in a way that we are practicing Islam by ourselves. And with our practices, the Islam is becoming alive. We are basically, when we are practicing Islam, people can see this Islam into our life, in our daily actions, in our speeches, in our practices. And if this is the case, then yes, we are under the banner of Islam, under the flag of Islam. But if we are not practicing Islam, and we have just named this country as Islamic country, then it is a slogan, the way there are other Muslim countries that they have the name of Islam on them, but inside when you go, you don't see, you don't find any Islam.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with the light.
Chinese scientists are establishing
a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the country's most high-profile robotics event, dubbed RoboCop Iran Open. The event seeks to promote robotics and artificial intelligence by holding tournaments. Yusuf Shalali has the story.
They may not be able to face human soccer players just yet, but these robot footballers are taking their baby steps toward achieving this goal. The 16th edition of RoboCop Iran Open brought together 100 teams from across the country to compete in different fields of robotics and artificial intelligence, with a focus on soccer robots.
Our robot is a soccer player that moves with its wheels. It's totally different from humanoid robots, but it can certainly challenge them and beat them in a football match.
We have taken part in the Maze League of the RoboCop games. It's the first time I'm involved in this big competition, where I have to implement all my programming, mechanics and electronics skills to win the game. I am so excited.
Organizers say RoboCop seeks to promote robotics and artificial intelligence by offering IT experts a real-time challenge to build the most capable robots.
The idea of RoboCop competitions is to increase the creativity of IT experts in developing efficient robots. Why soccer? Because first of all, it is a highly popular sport, and second, it is a highly strategic game that requires a robot to perform many difficult tasks, which, if accomplished, can turn them into strong and capable robots.
RoboCop Iran Open is part of the international initiative dubbed Robot Soccer World Cup, or shortly, RoboCop. The event was first launched in 1997 and was inspired by the victory of a computer chess player against the then world chess champion, Garry Kasparov. The official goal of the competition, as stated by its organizers, is to hone the capabilities of humanoid robot soccer players so that they will win a soccer game against the winner of the most recent FIFA World Cup in mid-21st century.
While robots still have a long way to go before they can challenge the likes of Messi and Ronaldo, the ultimate goal of RoboCop is not about robot footballers beating human rivals, but the technology advances that can be made along the way to improve our lives. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
There is a lot to be worried about when it comes to the climate. An Indian auto rickshaw driver in the capital, New Delhi, has come up with an innovative idea to beat the scorching heat wave. He has built a garden on the roof of his vehicle to keep passengers cool. Mahendra Kumar's vehicle, dubbed Moving Garden, stands out among others with its unique rooftop. He has grown vegetables, flowers and a variety of herbs and shrubs on the small roof space. Kumar says it was easy to make the garden by spreading a thick sack over a mat and covering it with soil. Then he added the plants, watered them and watched them grow.
Around 2 years ago, I had this idea during the peak of the summer season. I thought if I can grow some plants on the roof, it will keep my auto rickshaw cool and give relief from the heat to my passengers.
Kumar says the thick green keeps his three-wheeler cool even when temperatures reach 45 degrees Celsius. The rickshaw driver has also installed small fans inside for the comfort of passengers as an extra measure. His passengers say they feel cold because of the natural air conditioner. Kumar's rickshaw attracts many commuters for obvious reasons, and passers-by also stop to take selfies. A museum in France is hosting treasures of Peru, including the famed Machu Picchu, in a unique experience where technology meets archaeology. Visitors can immerse themselves in a vertical tour of Machu Picchu Citadel and see an exclusive exhibit of Peruvian archaeological objects. The collection is arranged chronologically, passing through the extraordinary diversity of some 13 cultures. The collection displays 200 artifacts spanning three millennia, dating as far back as 1500 BC. A large part of the exhibit is dedicated to Peru's Machica civilization with their vase portraits and red ceramics. The museum's curator says the goal was to show that pre-Columbus Peru was far deeper than just the Inca era. These days, it's easier than ever to get lost in the virtual world. A unique museum in the U.S. is using augmented reality for visitors to plug into a thrilling experience about the Earth's environmental challenges. The New York Museum is called Arcadia Earth. It offers a large-scale, multisensorial journey through underwater worlds, mountains, savannas, and inspirational fantasy lands. Each exhibit is brought to life through immersive technology and animated by augmented and virtual reality, including projection mapping. One installation is made of 44,000 plastic bags, the amount used in New York every minute before a plastic bag ban was implemented. The museum founder says the goal is to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change in a fun way.
The intention is to inspire people to come and leveraging game and immersive beauty to deliver a message. And I think that if this technique were to be used in school, we will so learn much more and every kid will want to go to school. And at the end of the day, the purpose is just to deliver the message. The tools are just techniques. So I really think that this technique, it's super fun and will work for everyone.
Vittori added that the experience is meant to encourage people to be proactive in protecting the planet. The exhibit also spotlights other environmental challenges such as overfishing and food waste. Proceeds from tickets sold are used to plant mangrove trees. This exhibit has been held in several cities across the United States, and each time proceeds have been used to support various environmental causes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Appearing like something straight out of a sci-fi movie, this Gundam-style robot lifts off special equipment and carries out maintenance work on out-of-reach railway contact lines in Japan. Developed by West Japan Railway Company JR West and two other Japanese companies, the humanoid robot can conduct repair work on overhead wires, which are considered high risk for humans. According to JR West, the prototype of this robot can be controlled by human operators through VR helmets and remote controls. It can lift objects up to 40 kilograms in weight with two hands to a height of 10 meters. It was designed to lower the risk of electrocution and falling for workers. The company says it can cut down human labor by a third. The company has been conducting tests since April and expects to put the robot into full service by early 2024.
A child-sized doll screams and rolls its eyes while lying on a table as engineer Hiroki Takimoto looks on calmly. But instead of being a child's toy, the doll is a humanoid robot mimicking critical medical symptoms designed to train dental workers. The robot was co-developed by Japanese robotic startups Team Sock and a local dental school. Pediaroid was designed to stimulate a child's responses when receiving dental treatment, including changes to its medical condition. Using a tablet programmed with different medical conditions, the user is able to send signals to air cylinders installed within the robot's joints to move its entire body, mouth, and tongue to display physical reactions and facial expressions.
Medical workers really need to experience medical emergencies. It's important that they experience a situation where something goes wrong, and that's what it can simulate. As for the future, we would like to further develop it in such a way that various other people who are involved with childcare, such as mothers, elementary school teachers, childcare workers, and nurses, can experience emergency simulations.
Director of Team Sock's engineering division, Yusuke Ishii, said the robot was developed due to the lack of clinical dental training to treat children. Currently, at a hefty price tag of about 25 million Japanese yen, Team Sock hopes to develop the hyper-realistic robot further such that people from other childcare industries, including pediatricians and elementary school teachers, would be able to use it for other emergency situation training.
How long could you work at your job? In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do, and there you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
IRIB English Radio.